From the Arizona Daily Star and Tucson.com, this is the Wildcast.
Hello, welcome to the latest edition of the Wildcast podcast, episode 200. And since it is the 200th episode, we have a nice round table of several members of the Arizona Daily Star sports staff. Unfortunately, we're shorthanded compared to last year, but we still have a whole lot of important people here. Ryan Finley, sports editor of the Arizona Daily Star, Michael Lev, Caitlin Schmidt, PJ Brown, Bruce Pasco, Dominic Bachaco. Of course, I'm Justin Spears. How's everybody doing, by the way? Happy summer to everybody.
Happy summer. Thanks for opening that podcast by talking about, you know, we're still okay. You know, the rest of us are still okay. No, man, we're good.
We're good.
200's weird for me, at least for those of us who were here when the Wildcaster started and the Wildcast podcast started. To me, it's hard to imagine. I mean, Lev, were you episode one?
I feel like I was. I feel like I was also episode zero. Which I don't know. Some of us were involved in. I don't know if that's ever been released out into the wild.
I remember going into a back room in the Star gutter, talking about with Lev and Zach Rosenblatt.
Yep.
I think that was like zero. I don't know if we ever used that, if that was ever live anywhere.
I don't think we did.
But I think that was like our first podcast.
Yeah, that was
like
the one
that was ground zero.
Yeah, that was the one in which I predicted that Khalil Tate would surpass Brandon Dawkins as the quarterback, which kind of did happen eventually. It didn't happen like coming out of training camp, but about a month later, you know, things changed as they do.
So you're saying that you predicted Khalil Tate would surpass Brandon Dawkins on a podcast that you claim to have recorded but nobody's heard?
I was there.
There were witnesses. Dom was there. He knows. Dom, can you come to my defense, please?
No, I'll back this up. I was there.
Okay, there. We got a witness. So we have a lot to talk about. We're pretty much recapping the entire academic year for the University of Arizona and the athletics department. We'll also look ahead to the 2019-2020 season. We'll also talk to Caitlin Schmidt, who had a very impressive Title IX series. It was incredible. I was really glad to be a part of it and produce the podcast series for that. So we'll hear from Caitlin in just a little bit, but I got to get everybody's opinion here. Athletes are the reason why we're all here. We talk about sports, and these players are the reason why we're all gathered here today. So when you look at all the sports from this past year, Kevin Sumlin was in his first season at Arizona, but he's a head coach. Lev, who's a football player that stood out to you in your mind?
The football player who stood out the most? I mean, obviously it was a disappointing season for the Wildcats. I don't think anyone expected them to go 5-7 when Kevin Sumlin arrives on the scene and he inherits this great quarterback in Khalil Tate. If you look at that team, Khalil had a good year, but not nearly the year that people thought. J.J. Taylor maybe surprised a lot of people with how effective a runner he was, and he did earn, you know, third-team All-America status. But I think most of us who followed the team knew how good he could be if given the opportunity. So I would say, like the football player of the year to me was Colin Schooler. And I know the defense overall did not perform that well, but just think of where they would have been without him. You know, I mean, he was the true quarterback of that unit. He was a leader on and off the field. He improved a great deal from his freshman year to his sophomore year. And I think he enters, you know, this upcoming season as, you know, probably the most valuable player on the team, the player they could least afford to lose.
Now let's shift gears over to the basketball side of things. I think the highlight that everybody has been talking about, the biggest storyline, arguably one of the biggest storylines in U of A sports this year, was the women's basketball team winning the WNIT championship from where they were a year ago. PJ, how many games did Arizona win?
They won six.
They went from
6 to 24.
So going from 6 to 24, and while it is the WNIT championship, for Adia Barnes to take that step in year three, right?
Yeah.
I think that's very impressive. In your mind, and I think this is a very easy answer, who's the best player on the Arizona women's basketball team?
It's Ari McDonald. If they don't have Ari McDonald, they don't make that run. And the interesting thing about that is everyone knew she was going to be good coming in because She was, you know, the third leading scorer at Washington when she was there behind Kelsey Plum and Chantel Osahar. And she came in and she had a whole season that she had to sit out and due to transfers. And they knew, we all knew she was going to be good, but just how good was, you could never say that she would end up being the third leading scorer in the country for women's basketball, that she would be, for single season, she would be the leading scorer for men's and women's at Arizona. She scored 890 points. No one could have imagined that.
What was, this is probably a better question for some of the more experienced gentlemen in the newsroom.
He's calling us old.
To put it politely. What was the last time we saw a team at the U of A make that kind of leap? I mean, go from 6 wins to 24 wins, pretty much irrelevant to WNIT champions.
That's a tough question.
If ever.
I can't think of a recent time. Certainly. And some of it too was, you know, frankly, it's a testament to like Arizona's men's basketball program. For the most part, they had never really bottomed out. I mean, yeah, you could talk about
across the board, right. That athletic department is a credit to them. There's very few U of A teams who've ever had that kind of losing percentage mm-hmm. ever. I mean, in the last half century, probably.
Right. And that went back years, right? I mean, that went back to sort of Nia Butts and the way things finished with her. And I think in Adia's, at least her first year, at least, she was still kind of paying the price for Nia Butts's complete, she did not recruit in her final year. She did not recruit,
a player
in her final year, because she knew that she wasn't coming back. But, you know, to me, what's more interesting is this. Is there a more fascinating player coach combo on campus right now than Adia Barnes and Ari McDonald? Both of them made such big leaps this year. McDonald, you could argue, may already be in the top 3 or 4 for greatest Arizona Wildcats women's basketball players of all time. And Adia Barnes, a graduate of the university, and Bruce, you know this, working on a brand new contract with a massive raise.
And a massive raise, $400,000?
Yes.
To $400,000.
From 235.
That's a pretty big jump. I mean, she was second to...
She was the lowest paid.
She was the lowest.
Not only women's coach in Pac-12, but in the Power 5.
Well, now she's getting a nice little paycheck.
Yeah, and she's still not... I mean, she's just under the middle of the pack in the Pac-12. So... While numbers wise, it's a big jump. When you put him against everybody else, she's still not like, you know, it's not like she won an NCAA championship and she's getting numbers that like Kelly Graves is getting or Tara, because she's the GOAT and has won the most and all of that. So she's not getting that kind of money, but she's getting really good. It's a good jump, and it's where she should be right now. She earned this. She deserves this raise for not only what she's done on the court, 4 in 3 years taking her team to WNIT championship, on the verge of going to the NCAAs from where they were, because this is not heard of across women's basketball. You don't do this in 3 years, but also for what she does off the court, for what she does in the community and how the girls are, you know, doing in the classroom. But it's really the community aspect of it. There's no way that they would have sold out at McHale for that championship game if it wasn't for what Adia Barnes does off the court and what she has her team do in the community.
You know what struck me too about that deal, PJ, was that she, not only did they give her a really good raise, but also locked her in. And that she has to pay $1 million if she leaves, even after next season, until I think next June. I could be wrong on that. And then $500,000 in 2021. And so that combined with the raise signal, it seemed to me that it was signaling U of A really, really believes in her and does not want her to leave.
Right. When I talked to Dave Hickey the day after they won the championship, and I had the Q&A, he told me he just was blown away by Adia the first time he met her. He sat down and her vision for the program for, you know, obviously where it was at that time, because it still was, it was right after her first year and they still, you know, she had a long way to go. And he said he walked away. He felt like she was like a role model and he was inspired and he wanted to really help in her reaching that vision for the university and for the program. And it was pretty amazing for me to hear an athletic director say that, to say like, I'm behind her 100% and I want to do everything I can do to help her.
It was obviously super impressive what they were able to do, the extent of the turnaround, how quick it was. To me, the other part of it that was super impressive was the attendance for the postseason. I mean, filling up McHale Center, I mean, with all due respect, women's basketball, I mean, it takes a backseat to men's basketball and football, right? Those are the quote-unquote revenue-generating sports in college athletics. There are a few places where that's an exception, right? UConn being one of them, Tennessee maybe, you know, Notre Dame, some of the top programs. Do you think that this will change how people view women's basketball at Arizona if they keep winning? Do you think attendance is going to spike next year? Can this become like a, you know, a sport that produces in the black?
Yeah, I think everything's changed as of the moment that, right, you know, going into the WNIT, all of a sudden they were averaging about 2,200 people at a game. So this year, it already changed from her first season, Adia Barnes' first season, when they averaged about 500 people at a game. The next year, maybe they got 800. And all of a sudden, this year, they were getting about 2,200. They got 4,500 for that ASU upset. And for them to, for anyone to get that many people during that WNIT run where it just accumulated and to the sellout, shows that it's changed. They've already sold, well, as of like a month, within the month after the WNIT, they had already sold a couple thousand, season tickets. And that was not even, and those were new season ticket holders. Those weren't even like the old guard who will always go because most of them saw Adia play as a student here, as a, you know, an athlete. And then now to see her coach, they're always in her corner. So the fact that that's happening, you know, they're probably going to average 5,000 or more this year. And it's just going to keep going. The better they do, the more people are going to be brought in. And when you have a coach like that, who comes back to her alma mater, and she's so dynamic. And then you have players like Ari McDonald and Kate Reese, and right down the line, the Sam Thomases and the T.T. Starks. You know, it's just going to get better, and they're going to have these five girls from overseas who are coming in, plus the two transfers this year, and you know, people are just going to keep getting more and more excited about women's basketball at U of A.
Really quick before we switch gears here, I think that's why, going back to what Bruce said about locking her up, that's why that's important, because they're not going to sell out McHale Center for women's basketball throughout the entire season, but there's always going to be interest around the program now because of what they've accomplished in such a short amount of time with a head coach that everyone can rally behind regardless of whether or not they're winning or losing. That's what's really important for moving forward.
And when you think about it, you know, the one thing I always think about is how much Adia Barnes is worth to the University of Arizona. I mean, I'm not talking salary wise. I'm just talking from, public perception. She's one of the best things they got going that anybody in any university would have going. You know, I mean, you put her anywhere if she, you know, it just happens that she came here and this is her alma mater and everything, but she is worth so much to this university, especially when, you know, there are other things that in the university that aren't so positive. She, every time she opens her mouth, every time she does anything, it's a positive action. And that, you know, somebody like that, it was smart for them to lock her up.
Let's shift gears over into the spring sports before we talk about men's basketball. We're going to talk about men's basketball later because there's a lot of headlines involving that program. So we'll get to Bruce in just a little bit. But let's do baseball and softball real quick. I know the softball team, they made it to the Women's College World Series in OKC. Another impressive season for Mike Candrea. I didn't even notice how dominant the softball team was until I looked at their postseason over the last 20 years. I think Mike Candrea has been to the Super Regional like 14 out of the last 15 seasons or something like that. Mm-hmm. Very impressive. Ryan, what'd you think about
It's run? Good. I'm pinch hitting for Norma Gonzalez. It's a matchup situation. I'm left-handed. She's right-handed. So, so we're playing the percentages. Here, Mike
Candrea. Good pitcher.
Mike Candrea is a New York Yankees fan of the first order. He is a huge baseball fan. I know.
I forgot to talk about
but, that. But he built his own little he built his own little version of the New York Yankees on this year's team. Basically, they slugged home runs at an almost unheard of rate. Jessie Harper, I think, was Arizona's best player. She only, you know, led the nation in home runs, played very solid in the infield, is somebody who's going to be a player they build around again next season. She was fantastic. But you know what? Alyssa Palomino Cardoza was fantastic too. She was healthy again, played great in the outfield, was their best hitter, I think, in Oklahoma City, where they were eliminated after three games. She was very good. And Taylor McQuillan, you know, went out on, I think, on top, leading her team to the Women's College World Series. I thought that she got over whatever sort of mental obstacle or mental hump she had had in previous years. I thought she looked really good. And, you know, when they got beat in Oklahoma City at the Women's College World Series, it wasn't necessarily because Taylor McQuillan had done anything wrong. In fact, in that elimination game, they had started Alyssa Denham instead. And when they brought in Taylor McQuillan, she dealt. And she pitched great. And so, you know, it's so funny on this sort of mini Bronx Bombers team. You know, Mike Candrea built around really good power hitters and solid pitching. And anybody who follows softball or baseball, frankly, understands that's a pretty good way to build a winner.
And the backbone, at least the last few years in their super regional runs, pitching has kind of been, they've always been able to lean on hitting, but they had Daniel O'Toole, then they had Taylor McQuillan, and they've always kind of had to go to ace to come up big when they needed him to.
Yeah, but that's the thing, though, is you need not only pitching, but you need dominant pitching. Arizona posted one of the most impressive regular seasons I've ever seen in softball this year. But, you know, when you get to Oklahoma City and you're facing Oklahoma, it's fabulous pitchers. Alabama's pitchers got hot once they got down there. UCLA with Garcia, you know, this is even Washington. I mean, Washington had two pitchers in Alvelo and, oh, I'm going to blow it on the other one. At least Taron Alvelo was one of them. Mm-hmm. They had two very solid starting pitchers. When you get there, it just gets that much harder. And, you know, Arizona, I think, probably impressed me by winning their opener against Washington, but just couldn't sustain it throughout the course of the tournament. And that's why they lost.
Ryan, how could you not know the second starting pitcher on Washington's softball team? Come on. So would you consider it a successful season for Arizona softball? If you make it to the College World Series, is that kind of where the line is drawn?
2011, right?
Yeah.
10.
Yeah, I would say so. Like, winning the national championship in any sport is so difficult, right? The goal for a program like Arizona softball, traditional power, is to make it to the College World Series, right? And then you take your chances.
Would you consider Arizona basketball getting to the Final Four and losing a successful season? But absolutely you would. That's 100%. What I mean, that's a good comparison. And I think for Arizona softball, it was important to get over. It sounds weird to say since we've been hyping them up and Kendra's success, but to get over the hump and win in the super regionals where they've lost at home recently in the last few years, I think it was important for them to get back to Oklahoma City.
Right. And you know, Lev and I, we've both been to Omaha for the College World Series. And Bruce has been to Final Fours and Elite Eights. Well, I know, but Bruce, but we've all been to those things. You know, it's not necessarily the best team that wins. You got to get there. You get there and you take your chances. And I think that with Arizona softball program, simply getting there was a major accomplishment. And whatever they were able to do once they got to Oklahoma City, whatever they were able to do there was just icing on the cake. And the Washington pitcher's name was Gabby Plain. So there we go. Lev, can I pitch it to you on baseball? Yeah. Who is the Arizona baseball team's best player? They had a bunch of them, which is pretty impressive for a team that, you know, did not make the postseason.
Yeah, it's impressive on one level. I mean, it's sort of exasperating if you're a U of A baseball fan that they had all these guys drafted in the first three rounds. They've had all these postseason All-America honors, freshman All-American, and they did not make the postseason as a team. So that's very frustrating. I would say that their best player this year was Nick Quintana. I know that Cameron Cannon has gotten more All-America accolades than Nick has, but when you take everything into consideration, including defense, Nick Quintana was a much sounder defensive player this year than Cameron Cannon was when Cameron had to move to shortstop full time. I mean, it was he had a week to forget. I mean, just a nightmarish week. I think he made 11 errors and over the course of five games, and those were costly. At the end of the day, he rebounded in a major way, improved defensively, ended up hitting .397, leading the nation in doubles. But Nick Quintana was more consistent. Led the Pac-12 with 77 RBIs, had a career-high 15 home runs, batted .342, played really good defense as well. So that would be my choice. I would say Nick. And both of them were second-round picks in the draft that was just held, which is something that hadn't happened for Arizona since, that was it 1985? They had three guys picked in the top three rounds. So it had been a minute.
Not to belabor the point, Michael Lev, but is there another sports analogy here? I mean, is this like having
Normally, it's always baseball.
But I mean, is it like having two first round picks in the NBA draft and missing the NCAA tournament? I mean, to me, it was impressive how much talent this team had, and yet where their season ended.
What Jay Johnson would tell you is that baseball is unlike any other sport in that the pitcher has such a profound effect on everything that happens, right? And their pitching just wasn't very good, you know, for the bulk of the season. And you just, as great as their offense was, and it was one of the top three offenses in the country, you just cannot rely on that on a game in, game out basis.
Your offense can be the best in the country, but if you have a starting rotation and bullpen that gives up 10 runs a game, you're starting at scratch.
Or you run into a really good pitcher, right, on a given day or over the course of a weekend in the Pac-12. It's just not a sustainable formula. Now, they're going to have a really good offense again next year. No question about it. I mean, they have all these freshmen coming back who are going to get better. And they were able to get Matthew Dyer to turn down, you know, the pros and come back. And he hit .393 last year and might play all eight positions in the field, which would be a really cool and novel thing. But it all comes back to pitching, right? I mean, the story of this past season for the Arizona baseball team was the lack of pitching, and the story for next year's team will be how much better will the pitching be. And if it's just decent, right? Like if they can have an ERA somewhere in the 4.5 range, which isn't that great, I think they can be a regional host next year.
Real quick, everyone, let's do just a quick roundup. Male athlete of the year and female athlete of the year. I'm going to start off with male athlete of the year. I'm going to go with Jordan Geist, thrower for the U of A track and field team and All-American. We saw what he did in the NCAA championships and the Pac-12 championships as well. I like Jordan Geist. And for my female athlete of the year, although they couldn't do it again this year, I'm going to go with Haley Moore. Women's golfer, because she's been clutch. You saw what she did last year against Alabama in the extra hole, and you consider that overtime?
Sure.
And then this year, who did they lose to? Was it Duke?
Duke.
But they beat the number one ranked USC team in the previous round, and that was because of Haley Moore. So Jordan Geist, Haley Moore, my athletes of the year.
I don't know if you could ask for anybody to do more than Ari McDonald did. So she's my female athlete of the year. I'll go with you on Jordan Geist. That's good. In a year in which Arizona basketball, I know we'll focus on that here in a minute. In a year in which Arizona basketball was down, in a year in which the football program underachieved, I think that Jordan Geist, you're right. He was the best of the best among the male athletes.
I'll let Lev go first on this because I think I might steal one of his players. Go ahead.
Geist is a good choice
okay. For
male athlete of the year, especially since, you know, the big quote unquote big male team sports were all kind of down to some degree, right? Obviously basketball, we'll get to that. Football, as you mentioned, had a disappointing season. Baseball did not make the postseason. I think the female athlete, it's tough. There's so many good choices, right? I mean, Ari McDonald was a one woman show at times. For that team, Haley Moore, you mentioned, I mean, so clutch, like legendarily clutch, but you know, I probably wouldn't vote for Haley because really her greatest, you know, most indelible moment happened in last season, right? And then there's so many softball players, right, who you could cite. Like Jesse Harper, you mentioned, I mean, not only leading the nation in home runs, but playing shortstop, you know, which is the most important position. So I'd say I'd go either Ari McDonald or Jesse Harper, and I'd probably lean toward Ari McDonald because they were able to win the WNIT, you know, which is not nothing.
Jesse Harper is definitely someone who has to be on the list. Or, I mean, you could throw Taylor McQuillan on there too, but I think Jesse Harper leading the country in home runs and being kind of the catalyst for Arizona's offense the entire season, she was always something they can lean on, and obviously took them to a College World Series. So Jesse Harper would be a pick. And then for male, like you guys said, there's not as wide of a field as there has been in years past because of some down years for football and basketball. Jordan Geist obviously has to be on the short list. If we're talking about players who mean a lot, not necessarily the player of the year, but players that had an impact and will be heavily relied on moving forward, Colin Schooler, I think, is on the list just because of what he means to Arizona's defense. I think he's a huge piece moving forward.
Okay. For women, obviously Jesse Harper is great. She's on the list. And, you know, someone on softball that people don't think about is Deja Molipola. Oh, very good. She's a phenomenal catcher, and she can hit. And they picked her to be on the USA team. And she's probably most likely, she's one of two college athletes on that team, and most likely she'll make the Olympic team. And she may have to sit out next year because of that. So she definitely, people forget about her. But and Haley is just incredible. And even this year, she made a putt against Duke. She came back and played great and won that match. And then she went 4-3. I mean, that was against SC. And then against Duke, she went 4-3 and she put the first point on the board. So she was incredible. But I got to go with my girl, Ari McDonald, because as you expect, because I don't think anybody has done what she did, and such an incredible year, and to really bring her teammates along. And so that in that run, they played like more like a team instead of Ari McDonald and everyone else. And to be able to do that as a player, I know it's coaching and everything, but as a player, you just can't say enough about what Ari McDonald means to that team.
And to put a bow on this, I think Ari McDonald's numbers next year won't be as good as they were this last year. They're going to be a better team, and they're going to be a more balanced team, and that means that her numbers are going to be more or less ridiculous than they were this last season. And that's a good sign, right?
You mean she's not going to repeat the best season men's or women's basketball at Arizona we've ever seen?
We may not be talking a year from now about her being the female athlete of the year, but that doesn't mean that she's any less successful. If anything, it means that her team is more balanced.
And what's going to happen? I've been talking to a lot of experts on Ari and what she's going to look like next year, because is she going to repeat? What's she going to do? And really what's going to happen is that she will get better in so many ways, and people may not notice, but she'll be more well-rounded and doing different things that will obviously help her team even more. Lanes are going to open up. Different things are going to open up. They won't rely on her as much. She may still have really great numbers, though. So watch out. She may not score 890 points, but she may have really top numbers. Mike Neighbors told me, he said, nobody thought that Kelsey Plum could come back and do and repeat what she did, and she just got better. So don't count Ari out.
Speaking of Haley Moore really quick, technically outside of the academic 18-19 school year, did she not, Ryan Finley, just win her second event as a pro? Or she finished in the top. Haley Moore, what did she just do?
She won her first event as a pro.
PJ wrote the story.
She was second in her first tournament. She won her first event as in the second tournament. She won it.
Okay, so Haley Moore is definitely on the short list.
Yeah, women's golf, by the way. I mean, what a competitive team. I mean, even when they bowed out of the the tournament or whatever you call it. They fought to the bitter end. I mean, like, those matches, like, came down to the final few holes.
Yeah.
You could just never count them out. I just love the competitive spirit of that squad the last 2 years.
And that, then that matchup against Duke, I talked to Haley about it, and she was like, you know, they were totally even. And the girl hit a shot out of the bunker, and she's like, that's like a once in a lifetime shot. She's like, we cheered for her. We couldn't believe she did it. And the thing is that Bianca was on her way to winning that. And she makes the other girl makes this incredible shot, and they won. So,
all right, now time.
Saving the best for last.
Bruce Pascoe and Caitlin Schmitz, time to shine. Bruce, as we know, the 2018-19 basketball season wasn't what we're accustomed to. Normally the Wildcats are in postseason play. Normally they make the NCAA tournament. But Arizona fell short. They lost in the first round of the Pac-12 tournament. They finished ninth in the conference. A disappointing season. But what the biggest storyline involving Arizona basketball is what happened not on the West Coast, but what happened in a courtroom in New York. Bruce, former assistant coach Book Richardson, was sentenced to 3 months in prison after bribery charges. What did you learn from the trial, and what is the state of Arizona basketball right now?
I think we learned from the trial that the NCAA has a lot of things to look at. Yeah, I mean, it was, especially that second week of that trial, it was almost like every day it was just Arizona, 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 something, Book Richardson on wiretap, et cetera. There were some things from the October trial, too, that they're probably looking into. But, you know, they just have to determine whether there's a link between if Sean Miller was behind any of this, if he wasn't, if it was all hearsay, and you had an assistant going and doing his own thing and pocketing the money. If that's the case, then it's probably less. Arizona's probably going to get penalized lighter than that. It probably be, in that case, would be more a matter of what do they view Sean Miller as having done, and did he monitor, did he fail to monitor between Book Richardson and Mark Phelps, who's been forced off the staff. So, you know, it's just it's a lot of things, because the whole federal trial was about something completely, you know, the way the feds were looking at it, the NCAA is going to be looking at it a little bit different, but that's going on right now.
We remember the date in late September. Was it 26th or the 27th? You remember?
26th.
The paper was the 27th.
Of 2017.
Of 2017. And I remember, you know, turning on the TV or looking at my phone and watching the press conference after they made the initial arrest. And the investigators said, we're going to expose the dark underbelly of college basketball. Did they do that after all of this?
Well, it really became a case from the FBI dropping it off in the hands of the prosecutors, and the prosecutors were going for victories, basically. So, you know, there was some argument. Certainly the defense attorneys in this last one argued, hey, we've got evidence that coaches or head coaches are cheating, the programs are cheating or whatever. You're not even looking into that. A lot of that was dismissed. Maybe there was nothing there. Maybe there was, whatever. But, you know, the prosecutors narrowed it down to these assistant coaches and what they did. And that's what they went for. And they won. They didn't get all of the charges to stick on this last trial, but they did get the victory, and that's what they were looking for.
Right. The prosecutors would probably tell you, yes, they did expose the belly of college basketball, right? But in reality, it's now up to NCAA. I mean, what did we get out of that? A few assistant coaches serving 3 month prison sentences and probation. It's up to the NCAA to figure out what they're going to do to fix it now, because nothing's going to change if all that happens is a couple of coaches going to prison for a few months.
Right. Do you think the NCAA wants to fix it? I mean, they say they do. Do you think that they truly want to fix a system that benefits them?
I think has
benefited them to the tune of billions with a B of dollars?
I think we'll find out with these sanctions that they're supposedly coming down with soon. No?
Well, there's a lot of pressure on them, and I think the fact that they have a senior executive, Stan Wilcox, who's been speaking out pretty vocally about, we're doing this, we're getting ready to issue notices of allegations, they usually don't comment at all about any of this stuff. And he's out there saying it's, and he said some things like, we're getting on it. We're on it. You know, here we go. It's go time. I think he said, I mean, they're making it clear that they are seriously looking into it and is, you know, taking it seriously. Cause there is a lot of people kind of sitting, everyone's kind of sitting back and wondering, where does the NCAA go with this? And, you know, if they don't do anything, does that say anything? But there may be some cases, maybe in Arizona's case, they don't link much because a lot of it was just guys talking and maybe there's no proof there. So, but certainly in some cases there was evidence that they can come down on, and we're going to probably find out in the next few months.
Well, yeah, and it certainly obviously depends on what kind of evidence the NCAA has, right? Because they have said outwardly that the FBI is not turning over all of their information that they use in the trials. So it definitely depends on what the NCAA has, and if they're working off different evidence than the FBI was to prosecute some of these head assistant coaches, then we're just going to have to wait and see.
Right.
Right.
Well,
I mean,
well, what's happened
we don't know what they have to get Miller or to get Booker. I mean, we don't know what they have on Book Richardson and all these programs.
Well, what's happened is they filed a motion from the first trial to try and get the evidence that was discussed but not admitted. They figure that the stuff was sealed and not even brought to the discussion point is not going to get out. So they're not fighting for that, but they're trying to get some of the other evidence. And I think the same's going to happen in April. So and that's why I think it could take a while to really process Arizona and some of the schools in the second trial, because I don't think all the things that they're going to be looking at are even in their hands yet. But they are certainly going to be way more limited. And as we know, they have virtually no investigative powers compared to the FBI. You know, they can't force people who aren't at schools to talk to them. They can't do videotapes or wiretaps or any of that kind of stuff. So they're going to have to largely go on what came out of this process in the trials, and you know, maybe try and get some interviews here and there and see if they can find anything else out.
Yeah, I have a question for Caitlin. So, you know, Justin mentioned, yes, our sports legal expert, Justin mentioned how, you know, they were trying to expose the dark underbelly. Is that the term, right? Do you think that Arizona's underbelly is darker than that of other schools, or is it just because people like you have looked into some of these issues that are taking place at Arizona, or the FBI just happened to choose Arizona as one of the schools it would pick on? And maybe this stuff is happening at schools all across the country. I guess is Arizona in worse shape than other schools, or do we just happen to know about some of this stuff?
That's a good question and a tough question. I mean, I think at the moment in some areas, they definitely are in worse shape than other schools. But if you look at what's happened, let's say, in like the past 10 years, it's really cyclical and it's a school of the moment. So, you know, a couple of years ago, Ohio State is in all the trouble. A few years later, it's Baylor in all the trouble. And it's just, it certainly has been a rough year or 2 years for the U of A. I mean, in terms of FBI and Title IX, I would say that at this very moment, we're not on the high end of schools that are doing well. We're probably in worse shape at the moment just because of all the stuff that we're involved in. But we have to mention that a lot of this Title IX stuff was in the past. We're just learning about stuff that happened years and years ago. The people that were in charge at the time are gone now for all intents and purposes. They're telling us that they have made changes to things like Title IX, to basketball. We've seen contract language, being inserted that we never saw years ago about mandated reporters, that sort of thing. So, I mean, when we talk about is it worse here than other places, I think it looks worse at the moment for sure. But I mean, a lot of this that we're digging up, like I said, with this Title IX is years old. We're just finding out about it.
Right. Bruce, a quick question for you. And we talk and you write and have written a lot about NCAA bylaw 11.1.1.1. Am I leaving a point one out of there somewhere?
I say 11.1.1.1.1.1.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all one.
Basically, it's the bylaw that says that a head coach is responsible for the actions of his assistant coaches unless he can prove that he fostered a culture of compliance, basically, and that these guys went rogue. Right.
Right. And as I understand it, that has to be pretty well documented. You have to have written records or some kind of recording about you've met with this guy every, you know, every week or so. And, you know, in the case of Christian Dawkins and Book Richardson, certainly Sean Miller would at least probably have been aware that he had a relationship with Christian Dawkins. And you would think that at that, to prove it, he'd probably have to say, hey, Book, be careful dealing with this guy, et cetera. Right. Do not do this. Do not do that. He'd have to have proof of that. So that could be an issue. It is interesting if Book Richardson is now saying Sean Miller didn't know anything about this. If he tells the NCAA the same thing and they go with that rather than the wiretap in the courtroom where Book Richardson said Sean Miller was buying DeAndre Ayton, et cetera. If they go with that, then, you know, maybe it is more about just what Book Richardson did, and there's a little bit of a monitoring penalty, and it may not turn out to be that severe. But we do know that that U of A's lawyer has said in their victim statement, for what it's worth, that they expect they're bracing for pretty significant sanctions.
For potentially significant sanctions. Yeah. One of the things, though, and this is my question, is we know that the NCAA is fairly toothless. They don't have subpoena power, et cetera, et cetera. Could they sit there and just say, well, he violated, or, you know, whether it's Rick Pitino or Bill Self or Sean Miller, sit there and go, well, all of this is just 11.1.1.1, and so we're going to hammer him hard. I mean, is that sort of their...
Yeah, and then you're talking about, the question is, do you just suspend Sean Miller for a handful of games and maybe take away a scholarship or something, or do you figure that this whole failure to monitor justifies a postseason ban, which is the one sanction everybody really cares about? Mm-hmm. And that's that's something we just don't know. And, you know, maybe, you know, I do think there is pressure on the NCAA to come down. So it wouldn't surprise me to see it go really one way or another.
Well, I think with this lack of institutional control, it goes back to Mike's question about whether Arizona is worse than other schools. Lack of institutional control. With this, you have to oversee everything. You have to be the manager of your program. Book Richardson isn't the only assistant coach that's been under a negative light. You saw what Joe Pasternak, his name was tossed around in the Adidas trial. And then Mark Phelps, he committed two NCAA violations while here at Arizona. So that's three assistants under Sean Miller's watch. Of course, in the NCAA's eyes, I think they're going to look at Arizona as well. They don't really have much control of their program.
And if you look outside of basketball, even the Title IX lawsuits that we're talking about, the U of A is accused of fostering an environment in the football program for 5 years in which Title IX was disregarded and sexual misconduct was swept under the rug. Yeah. If that's true, talk about a lack of institutional control.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Two very separate conversations.
But yes. Two very separate conversations.
Lack of institutional control.
Right. Well, and I'm curious, you know, when we were covering that second trial out in New York City, we had some coach tell Adam Zagoria, one of our freelancers, that the sport is being audited right now. And, you know, my question is what's happening at Arizona and at schools throughout the country, if you were to audit Washington State, or if you were to audit Illinois, just pick another school, what would they find? Is what is happening at Arizona and other schools far more in line with the norm in men's college basketball in the year 2019, or are these renegade programs? I mean, it's an unknowable question, right? There's no answer, but that's the question, right? I mean, is this the way college basketball is played now? I don't know.
There's been discussion about that for literally decades and decades. Yeah. Yeah. It's just a matter of to what extent or whatever, but the general thought seems to be at the high major level. And I think this was maybe reflective of the high number of schools that were implicated one way or another. General school thought is, you know, maybe half of really high major teams are, you know, kind of pushing that gray area, you know, whether or not they're going over. But, you know, it's really hard to say. I mean, it does go to show you that whatever you think there's the more and more money we get in this game, the more pressure there is from the black market. You know, people like Adidas want, you know, apparently they're trying to get players to represent them. And, and the whole rules about amateurism are making a lot of that stuff kind of go underground. And, you know, how deep it is, how many schools are involved, is, you know, nobody can really say.
So this may be a product of me just spending too much time, like, reading message boards, but I feel like there's a perception out there that Dave Hickey is not doing a good job. And I don't really know where that comes from, because it seems like if you look at the timeline of all this quote-unquote bad stuff that has happened, most of it happened before he got here, right? He sort of inherited a mess. Same thing with President Robbins. Like, he was not the president of the school when a lot of this bad stuff happened with basketball and football. So my question for Caitlin and for others here in the roundtable is, do you feel like things are headed in a better direction? Are they headed in the right direction under the leadership that wasn't really here when a lot of the bad stuff went down?
I mean, it's a mixed bag, I think. They definitely have been very strong in their statements about basketball and oversight and what they're going to do there. And they have made a lot of statements about changes to Title IX. But that process has been really slow moving. Like, aside from the new Title IX director and somebody brought in to oversee prevention education, to my knowledge, we have no more Title IX investigators than we did when they hired Ron Wilson in November of 2018. Yes, they have brought on a survivor advocacy program, but we don't have a new Title IX policy in place. That's been on the back burner for several months. Ron did submit a draft, but where has that been? I mean, look at how fast Baylor made changes. Baylor revamped that entire program in and outside of athletics in less than 2 years. We're going on year and a half. It's been a year and a half since U of A hired the lawyer to look into Title IX, essentially, and we've seen very, very little change, very slow movement. They've talked a great game, but I'd like to see it move faster.
Yeah, I would say, too, that if you're going to criticize the current regime for anything, they could be more transparent.
Yes, definitely.
Right? I mean, you can speak to how difficult it has been to obtain some of the documents that we're supposed to have the legal means to obtain, right?
Right. Yeah, at one point I had more than a dozen records requests outstanding, some of them as long as 18 months. They have since U of A has turned over all their records requests to me. We're in good standing, but I mean, that's kind of unacceptable. 18 months, and they weren't anything that should have been kept secret. It was about the basketball investigation. It was stuff everyone was asking for. You would have thought they would have kind of gotten a move on with some of that.
If I had to guess, though, if we're talking about either a lack of transparency or maybe a lack of action by either Dave Hickey or Bobby Robbins, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact, and this is just my guess here, attorneys are pretty explicit with what they should and should not be sharing with the public. I think that attorneys and the ongoing internal investigation that's going on over there, I think is really, I mean, nobody is saying anything. And I don't think that's the best policy, but my guess is that's what their attorneys are telling them to do.
Sure. But you have to wonder, I mean, at one point, you and I waited, 4 months to sit in a meeting with Title IX people to talk about the training that's made available to student athletes. That should have never happened. That should have been made available immediately. There are definitely things that we know and we have to acknowledge that they are bound by legal situations that they can't talk about. But the overwhelming response has been just kind of disappointing. President Robbins has never agreed to talk to me about Title IX. And he could flat out say to me, hey, this all happened before me, this isn't my problem, and still have a conversation. But that conversation still hasn't happened. So there's a lot, I think, that could be said or done that isn't being done still.
So, one lingering question I have about basketball is, what's going to happen next year? I mean, we don't know what the NCAA punishments are going to be or when they're going to come down. But like, as of right now, as we're having this discussion, Arizona is projected to be in the top 25, right? And it may be even better than that. And they've got this amazing recruiting class coming in with all these projected first rounders. So what do you think, Bruce? Like, looking into the crystal ball, like, what's 2019-2020 going to look like?
Well, I don't think they'll be penalized for this year. I think the timing is such that I don't know. If I had to guess, I mean, they say maybe by the end of the summer they're going to have 6 schools notified of allegations. But even after that, schools have 90 days to respond, and then they get to and then they're sanctioned. So even if Arizona's in that first group, that might not be completed until, I don't know, December, January. And at that point, for them to say you're not playing in the postseason this year is hardly ever done. Usually they wait another year past that. Plus, I'm not convinced Arizona is in that first group of teams that are going to be notified, because I do think there's still some stuff they're trying to process from the previous trial. But it's hard to say there. But so if I had to guess, I think the timing is such that they'll be okay this season, and probably, their issues is going to be a lot of new guys and a lot of young guys. And yes, they're very talented, but as we've seen in college basketball, when it comes down to the NCAA tournament, a lot of times it's a team with returning players and experiences that actually go the furthest. So, they did add a couple of you know, grad transfer pieces that will help them, you know, an experience. They've got a, you know, Chase Jeter coming back kind of a, as a leader and a, you know, real mature experienced guy that will help them that way. But they're going to have to get that meshing together with that new talent.
Right. By the way, since we never asked you, who's their MVP of the last season?
Well, actually, I think their most valuable player was Nico Mannion, because he was the catalyst to that recruiting class, which frankly was the thing. And that's not, I mean, that's not to to disrespect anybody on the current team. I think Brandon Williams had a very good year, was got much better until his knee came down, and he was probably their valuable player on the floor. Mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, I think the team gives him a lot of props for coming back to that recruiting class, which was all but destroyed in 2018. And then he played pretty well on the floor and again got better. But Mannion was probably the biggest deal in the sense that, that he was the first of the really big time players to commit to that 2019 class and basically send a message that it's okay, go ahead, come join me. And people like playing for him. He's good friends with Josh Green. Josh came aboard and, you know, and they got a couple other pretty nice pieces as well, you know, after that.
I think for Arizona in 2019-20, it's just a matter of playing basketball. The players, the current team, Sean Miller, can't do anything about what's going on off the court. Similar to the DeAndre Ayton team of 2 years ago, they had a lot of stuff outside of McHale Center that they had to deal with. Sean Miller served a one-game suspension, or it sat out for a game. I don't know what the correct language for that is. He missed a game. Alonzo Trier was in some hot water with PEDs. So there was so much going on off the court that they handled well until the tournament and a first-round loss to Buffalo, where maybe some of it caught up to them. But for this year's team, there's going to be noise off of the basketball court. It's just going to be a matter of how they can handle it and play it, because they're going to be good. They're talented. I mean, they're going to be, Lev said, a top 25 team. They could be a top 10 team. They could be one of the best teams in the country if all of the freshmen play up to par. So for them, it's just going to be blocking out everything that's extra and playing basketball. More awkward.
The last 2 years, though, as far as that goes, I think they'll have a big announcement at some point when the NCAA stuff comes out, but they've got Book Richardson. He's been processed. They've got Mark Phelps out. They've got a new staffer. Jack Murphy came in. So there's a little more potential stability there. They should be better off in that aspect.
More awkward press conference moments are coming, though, and I'm sure Bruce is looking forward to those.
If they even have them. I mean, there's been no access to virtually anybody lately.
A lot more Phoenix reporters coming down to Tucson and asking the big question. You know, there's key words that you don't ask Sean Miller, or that if you ask him, he's going to give you the no comment. Federal trial, FBI, Book Richardson, outside noise. Like, those are the key words, and then you're going to get the no comment, followed by you could drive back to Phoenix.
Well, that's the thing. I mean,
some other comment.
It's really become where the press conferences don't really matter that much, at least the last year. I mean, it's more about what's come out of the trials, what's happened with the staffers, with Mark Phelps being removed. What are some of the players saying when they felt, I remember Justin Coleman saying he felt it was really tough to see Phelps be let go. And those kind of things say more than the press conferences lately, anyway.
And winning, I don't want to say cures all, but it definitely helps. Last year, I think a lot of the focus is what was happening off the court and in the trials that Sean Miller was getting brought up in, because there was nothing on the court to talk about. There was no product that was exciting or that was winning, and there wasn't a whole lot to talk about after games outside of, hey, Sean, you were named in this report or in this trial. Can you comment on that? So I think, again, if Arizona plays up to par this year, as many of their five-star freshmen are expected to play, I think that will kind of, the no comments and those questions will kind of fade for the time being. That's until something else happens or something else comes up. But again, it's just up to Arizona to play basketball.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the no comment stuff, that was the first time around was a legitimate thing. He was being asked about being subpoenaed. It had just come out that he was going to be subpoenaed for the trial, and it was a legitimate question to ask at least once. And, you know, and that's what happened last year. There were a number of things that came up, and somebody had to ask him, and yeah, he would say usually no comment, or I refer back to my statement or whatever, and that's fine. So maybe now that the trials are over and again, Book Richardson's been gone, there won't be as many occasions where those questions need to be asked. It'll be more about when, if and when something comes down with the NCAA.
Yeah, we're in the narrative business, right? Mm-hmm. And they can change the narrative this upcoming season by just playing better, right? By being one of the best teams in the country. It just takes the attention away from the stuff that no one really wants to talk about or deal with, but you have to, of course, because it's, mm-hmm. it's still lingering. But you know, they have the power to change that by just playing really good basketball.
Well, what's exactly, I mean, what's the biggest news? If you get inside in a press conference with Sean Miller sitting at a table, is the biggest news the product on the court, how they played that day, or is it what's happening off the court? Frequently last year, it was the biggest story was what was happening off the court. So that's what was talked about. If Arizona, again, if they change the narrative, then we'll have some basketball to talk about.
If somebody
about.
Gets subpoenaed, right. that's going to that, be a definitely bigger come deal up no again. Matter how right. good the team is playing. Mm-hmm. But,
absolutely.
You know, there's maybe the whole news thing a little bit that way was a little bit slanted because you're right, the team wasn't very interesting by their standards usually. But there are also personalities on the team that can be very interesting that kind of can deflect that. And I don't think that a lot of that is sort of allowed to come out, and that can also help them too.
Real quick, everyone, since we have a few minutes left here, what are key storylines or key headlines that you're looking forward to or you're most interested in for the 2019-20 season? Lev, we'll start with you.
Well, I mean, with football, it's Khalil Tate, right? Heading into his senior year, you know, which version of Tate are we going to get? You know, are we going to get some semblance of the 2017 Tate who kind of lit the college football world on fire, or are we going to get more of last year's version, which was kind of more of a pocket passer, an effective pocket passer, but someone who was, you know, hesitant at times to run for a variety of reasons? Are we going to get some combination of the two? It's kind of like, I don't know, it's like version 3.0 or something of that nature. I think version 2.0 is disappointing to a lot of people because he wasn't the same dynamic guy. And I think his performance, it can be the difference between them going 6-6 and going like 8-4 or 9-3 or something like that. Like he can be that much of a difference maker for that team or really for any team.
Kaylin?
I will be looking to see what happens in these Title IX federal lawsuits. We have some deadlines in July for settlement conferences and joint reports. I will be shocked if we see this go to trial, which if it happens will be happening towards the end of the year. And we should all remember that we just saw a settlement in the Craig Carter lawsuit, close to $1 million paid out to the victim after spending close to $3 million defending the case over 3.5 years. So the good news is we're not looking at a 3.5 year timeline on this one. It should be wrapping up really quickly. So be interesting.
Keep ruffling those feathers, Caitlin.
That's right. I'm going to try.
PJ?
For women's basketball, it's really going to be, once again, about how they improve this year and the new dynamic of this freshman class coming in and what they're going to, how the team is going to develop in playing more as a team and not relying on just one person, and how strong they will be as a team, and how their scheme is going to keep changing depending on the talent they have and how it's going to become more sophisticated as we go. I'm really excited about the development of Sam Thomas and Kate Reese, along with some of the others, obviously Ari and everything. But you know, how is Kate going to come along? How is Sam going to come along in her junior season? And then also this will be the final season for T.T. Starks, because this is really her last season. Dominique McBride and Lucia Alonso. I'd like to see how they improve over the off season. So it will be exciting. Most likely they'll make the NCAAs, which will be huge because they haven't made it, and we'll get all those stats in probably, what, like 14, 15 years or something. And so that's going to be it's going to be a really exciting season with all the newcomers coming in, and to see what Adia Barnes has up her sleeve for this season.
Bruce, really quick, you have any storylines you're looking forward to next year?
Well, we talked about a lot about basketball already, mm-hmm. but I think the one thing we didn't mention, to me anyway, is the style of play, because Nico Mannion and Josh Green particularly, I mean, Sean Miller's already talked about how they're going with more three guards and more perimeter oriented when we saw that a little bit last year. But now he's got way more talent coming in, and particularly I think Mannion and Green, from everything I've seen and heard about them, they play much better in an open court situation. So it'll be interesting to see if this team really kind of puts on an accelerator a little bit more with these guys.
Definitely. I think it's an exciting time for Arizona athletics because it's no longer just Arizona basketball and Arizona football. The softball team is really prominent again. Of course, they always have been, but perhaps now more than ever. The Arizona women's basketball team is at its peak in the last umpteen years. There's so much extra stuff going on off the court, but for all the non-revenue making sports, it's a really exciting time. Women's golf, it's going to be interesting to see how they can back everything up. I know Lauren Ianello has a really exciting recruit. I can't put a name on her right now, but she has someone coming in who she says is essentially Haley Moore 2.0. So that's going to be really exciting. I think it's just a fun time for all of the non-revenue sports and to see what they can do in the next year. Jordan Geist, what can he keep doing track and field? There's a lot of names to keep eyes on.
You know, since I'm a football guy, I got two quick ones. The first one, the season opener at Hawaii, Michael Love will be out there. Dick Tomey coached at both Hawaii and Arizona. For that to be the season opener, that's just really cool to see. So I think Hawaii, they're going to have something ready. Both teams are going to work together to honor the winningest coach for both programs of all time. So I'm curious to see that. I'm also more interested in seeing how Arizona football changes its recruiting style, because we saw with four-star safety Lathan Ransom, he was offered by all of these crazy schools. And when he trimmed his five schools down, none of them included one, an Arizona school, and secondly, a Pac-12 school. I talked to Lathan, again, he does a series with the Star called Ransom Notes. And when we were talking to Ransom about it, you know, he said, it kind of bothered me that Arizona wasn't the first offer. It took Cal and ASU to offer him before Arizona got on board. And then when Arizona offered him and all these other schools followed up, when the LSUs and when the Michigans and all those big time schools, when they started offering him, Arizona backed off. And for a player that plays 5 minutes up the road from you, you don't back off just because Jim Harbaugh or Nick Saban's on campus. You got to do everything you can to make sure you lock in these local guys, because South Point, as we know, they have a lot of really good players. And if you develop that pipeline right away, you Kevin Sumlin can pretty much just have this funnel of the best talent in Tucson going straight to the University of Arizona. So I'm more curious to see how the recruiting tactics change up. So Ryan, any thoughts? Well, Ryan's asleep right now. So, well, that'll do it for this episode of the Wildcast Podcast 200, episode 200. I appreciate every single one of you for coming out and talking about sports, talking about all the headlines from this past year. Don't forget to download the Wildcaster app on the App Store, Google Play. You don't need a subscription to the Arizona Daily Star. It's free. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts. For everybody here from the Wildcaster team, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.